jury's like, oh, snap, a twist. Like, they love twists. Any great trial has a twist.
I suggest that we give him 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in Smallworth.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
Like this, Mr. Court.
Address the judge as your honor.
Well, it was like this, my honor.
Your honor, not my honor.
Why? Don't you like him?
You're meant to come down here and defend me against these characters, and the only one I've got on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 303. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am doing fantastic. We are T-minus 5 days from our live show in New York, and I just couldn't be happier.
Me neither. I'm also excited for the music deep dive later in the show. I mean, there's going to be chord progression charts and circle fifths. It's going to be just a masterclass in music later, as so many people have asked us about the Katy Perry and Flame lawsuit. So, I mean, we're really going to have to dig into the theory behind those songs. So let's,
are you team? Well, I guess I'll ask you at the time. So yeah, we will hold in suspense whether you are team Katy Perry or team Flame
or team kill yourself.
I think everyone knows we're both team kill yourself.
Oh man. So that'll be fun. But before that, we've got to talk about some serious stuff. We've got I'm seeing here good news. Scores of horrible Trump judicial nominees confirmed. Yeah, that sounds right. And the Facebook penalty. That's going to be interesting to talk about. Can't wait to get Andrew's deep dive insights into that. So what do you say? We ready to go?
Yeah, let's do it.
Good news! There's a report on TV with some very bad news.
All right. Well, give us the bad news, Andrew. How screwed are we?
So here's the bad news. Thanks to the fact that Mitch McConnell has nothing remotely approaching ethics or fair play, you should know this already, he rammed through another nuclear option with respect to Trump's judicial nominees. The last one, of course, reduced to 50, reduced to a bare majority, the number of votes necessary to confirm judicial nominees. This one reduced the total number of hours to debate before invoking cloture on a judicial nominee. And by the way, the cloture vote is what the filibuster vote is, right? Like, that's why when you watch the old-timey, like, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, what makes a filibuster is you say, move for cloture. There's no cloture. That means you keep debating. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, the
Jimmy Good Stewart's got to stand. His eggs are eggs. I was going to say his legs are aching, but his eggs are laking is also works. His eggs right. are laking. Speaking Jimmy of old timey, I can't even believe we didn't even get to talk about the new intro. That was a huge oversight by us. We got some old timiness in there. So you're welcome, everybody.
Yes,
but here's the funny thing about old timiness. I saw those quotes written, like people in the thread were like, oh, do this one where it's like, oh, your honor, my honor. And in reading it, I was like, oh, that's hilarious. And then I hear the delivery, which is like the old timey, like, why don't you like him? And I'm like, that's not funny, but that's okay. It was a lot funny. It's a lot funnier in print than like 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in 12th. I thought it was, when I read it, I was like, that's hilarious. And then I hear it and I'm like, oh, wow. Times have changed. Delivery.
This is Thomas telling you that our intro sucks.
No, so. It's great. It's still funny, but it's also just old timiness. Like, people change so much that the like tones of voice and stuff, like, it doesn't work. Delivery has to change. But anyway, sorry. That was a huge oversight on my part to not mention that earlier. But old-timiness, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Jimmy Stewart, what do you got?
So under the new nuclear option, thanks to Mitch McConnell, the total number of hours that will be spent debating each and every one of Trump's judicial nominees is 2. That's 2 hours per person, not 2 hours per all of them, which, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know why they didn't go for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't know that until you said it. Could have been.
By contrast, Robert Mueller testified for 6.5 hours. So, you know, if you think that maybe we ought to have at least as much debate over somebody who's about to get a lifetime appointment to the federal bench that, you know, we did kind of one good day that just barely managed to scratch the surface of the Mueller report. Yeah, we're getting about a quarter of that. So, and as an update, right before the Senate adjourned at the end of August 1st for a 5-week August recess, we had the initial confirmation hearing for a non-friend of the show, Justin Walker, the person I debated who, by the way, after describing on this show how manifestly not qualified Justin Walker is to be a federal judge, he was rated not qualified by the American Bar Association. Wow. The American Bar Association is not a crazy liberal special interest group. That's the thing to which all of us lawyers belong. It is manifestly not only nonpartisan, it is not biased, you know, plaintiff versus defense, right? It's the American Bar Association. Their ratings are the gold standard for judicial nominees. And Justin Walker, no surprise, rated not qualified.
It's almost like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But he's 37 and he's a right-wing zealot, so that's enough.
Yeah.
His confirmation will not come until the fall. But never to be outdone, Mitch McConnell tried to ram through 19 separate federal judges in the last day and a half of the Senate's business. Of those 19, 13 actually made it off the calendar. And of those 13, 11 refused to say that Brown versus Board of Education was properly decided. That's not a joke. That's not a partisan attack. And let's make sure that I'm confining my statements on that, right? I'm not saying 11 of 13 said Brown v. Board was wrongly decided. I am saying that 11, when asked the question, do you believe that the single most important case of the 20th century, Brown versus Board of Education, was, under your insane, stupid judicial philosophy, properly decided, they said, I don't know that I'm going to comment on that.
Right.
That should terrify you. But because it's the end of August and because 7 Democratic senators are running for president, 8 Democrats were already on vacation because of the debates, right? So Michael Bennett,
made any difference?
So it would not have made a difference other than if all of the Democrats had been there and the 2 Republicans who took off, Richard Burr and Johnny Isaacson from North Carolina and Georgia, respectively, had not shown up. Then it still would not have made a difference. but all of these votes, you're going to see these votes are 54 to 36, 50 to 40, 51 to 39. Those are close votes because, you know, you should add 8 onto the losing side. I can't blame, right? Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Liz Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker. I can't blame them for not showing up to cast their votes in what was a doomed effort anyway, because all these 13 nominees were crammed through. The closest that anyone came was Jeffrey Brown, who was nominated to be the U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of Texas. He passed 50 to 40, and that was all 39 remaining Democrats plus Susan Collins voting no. He's a monster, and I can, you know, give you the civilrights.org press release on opposing the confirmation of Jeffrey Brown to the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Texas. Didn't matter. He was somebody who, while on the Texas Supreme Court a year after Obergefell, wrote a dissent arguing that Obergefell did not apply in the state of Texas. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, and there is some legal nuance, but no, he's a monster. I should also add, if you are looking, we flagged this after the election. If you are looking for, if you think hating Joe Manchin is kind of passe, and you are looking for a Democratic senator to hate on newly elected Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who has voted for 12 of, she voted for everybody except Brown. Wow. She's been voting fairly solidly with Trump.
Is this Trump? Yeah. Is this like trying to get your Trump rating to a more like a place where you can run in a purple state and like picking meaningless votes to go along with Trump? Do you think that's what it is? Or
I do. I think absolutely that this is, and I'm glad that you asked it that way, because again, we have an audience that ranges from far left to moderate left, with a few handfuls sprinkled in. I want to be clear here. I am very happy that Kyrsten Sinema represents Arizona and not a Republican.
Yeah.
I do believe that Kyrsten Sinema will be a valuable vote on legitimately close votes where there are Republicans that can potentially cross the aisle. I also believe that she is a political opportunist who would like to be governor of Arizona, president of the United States someday. It is really clear to me that she's trying to build that resume. And look, part of that is the definition of being in politics, right? So, yeah. I think you've called that exactly correctly, that what she is doing is looking to burnish her moderate credentials by voting with the Republicans where it doesn't matter.
Right. But I mean, we're just screwed for 30 years on this, right? I mean, what are we going to
ever? Yeah, no, we've said it all along, unless there is a radical plan to reshape the judiciary. And you could do that, right? You could amend the Judiciary Act of 1789. You could add lots more, right? You could double the size of every existing district, right? Hmm. So there is nothing to prevent.
Well, we probably
Democratic
need
Congress.
More judges anyway, right? Aren't you
yeah,
always
no,
talking
about? And that's right. Like, and the courts are badly understaffed.
Yeah,
right. So it,
let's
it would
fund
not
those
be,
things. Why can't yeah. that be a something Democrats run on? Let's fund them.
Yeah, it absolutely.
Or will that
could
be looked
be.
At as like
necessary.
Being hard on criminals kind of thing? But I, yeah, it's not really that, right?
No, because these are yeah, courts these are, of okay. you know.
I'm just sorry. These I'm just are, thinking aloud. Yeah. Like, how will this be spun? But I think it would be good if you know more people got the justice they deserve in different ways for things. You know,
yeah, than, absolutely. Yeah. Look, increasing right now. We have talked about this on previous shows. The grotesquely overworked federal docket has horribly pernicious effects in both the civil and especially in the criminal political system, right? So it is right now, it is virtually impossible to want to try a criminal case, right? The judge is going to push you to settle. The prosecutor is going to push to settle. And we know we did a previous show.
So that means agreeing to deals when you might be innocent,
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. And the way in which right, so it's the worst of both worlds, right? Because you have the incentive for the prosecutor to overcharge you, and the poorer, less educated, less access that you have to competent legal counsel, the worse that is, right? Their incentive is to overcharge you. Hey, look, you could be in jail for 20 years. Why don't you plead guilty to this offense and, you know, you'll be out in two. And we know, I mean, statistically mm-hmm. speaking, we know lots of people, say, yeah, you're right. I don't want to roll the dice with my liberty, even though I am maintaining my innocence, I'm going to be coerced into this kind of a plea. And if you doubled the number of judges, then, you know, you reduce that incentive correspondingly. So I'm all for it. You know, we'll see. Liz Warren apparently listens to the show. So if you're listening, add that to things that you have a plan. Hi. Yeah. I believe Louisiana is the Pelican State.
We love you and we want you to be president. Come on our show.
Yep. There we go. Okay. All right. So there you go. Right before the summer break, the Mitch McConnell. Yeah.
So
the
we're
Senate.
Screwed for 30 years unless Liz Warren has a plan for it, maybe. Yep. And we also deliver the Senate for her for like 8 years. Do all that, everybody.
Yep.
And then everything will be fixed. Okay. Let's get to our main segment, though. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Joybird. Hey, I've got a little good news, bad news for you, in my personal life anyway. Here's the bad news first. I'm still sleeping in the guest room because we have an infant that can't sleep through the night, and it's better to be able to have one parent get some amount of sleep. Here's the good news, though. I'm on that Joybird couch. We've got the Joybird fold-out couch in our guest room. I love it. It is perfect for what we need. We were able to customize it, get everything we wanted for the room, and especially that pull-out bed with it, because that was really the key in my mind. Joybird empowers you to create the furniture and space that brings you joy, or in my case, sleep and joy, both of them. With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture crafted to your unique tastes. You can turn your ideas into reality with hundreds of styles and options. You want a sofa in aquatic blue or indigo, a love seat in the hottest red, an inviting coral. Ooh, coral, that sounds interesting. Or even bubblegum pink. If you can dream it, Joybird can make it a reality. And their free personal design consultants help nail down your perfect design. And as always, my favorite part of Joybird is their 365-day home trial. You skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. You can sit on it. You can sleep on it. You can break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return for a full refund. There's a hassle-free in-home delivery. They'll even take and remove all the packing materials and free returns within 2 weeks of delivery. So that means I'm still in my 365-day home trial. Tell you what, though, I don't need it. I love my Joybird couch, and we're not returning it. But hypothetically, if I didn't like it, you've got that free trial for a whole year. That's incredible. See how Joybird can help you design your dream space. Find your joy today at joybird.com/OA. Create the furniture that brings you joy today at joybird.com/OA. One more time, that is joybird.com/OA, and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using that code OA. So, Facebook got a slap on the wrist, a $5 billion slap on the wrist, or is that a harsher penalty than I'm saying? But tell us what's going on with Facebook here.
Yeah, that top line is correct, right? So the FTC, this is in connection with the Cambridge Analytica, as well as numerous other privacy breaches, reached a settlement with Facebook 2 weeks ago, under which Facebook is going to pay $5 billion and adopt certain changes to its business model. And this is slightly more complicated than I thought kind of in initially looking at it. So I thought this would make for a great deep dive, and we can learn all about the Federal Trade Commission and what this means. So the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is an independent agency. Okay. It was created by the FTC Act of 1914, which is 15 U.S.C. Section 41. The FTC has a 5-member board, and the way in which it was initially created, that board, every member of the board is appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate, right? So again, until Mitch McConnell broke our country, you know, this was the president would nominate, and then it took 60 votes to get out of the Senate. The commissioners serve a 7-year term. And by the way, the first term was staggered, right? They served 3, then 4, then 5, then 6, then 7. So it's really, really clear when you look at that. In 1914 terms, the idea was, oh, we're going to make this nonpartisan, right? we're going to have them serve 7-year terms and the president serves 4. So, you know, it's likely to fall. And then we're going to stagger each and every person. So we don't want this to be a political board. The FTC regs require, sorry, the FTC Act requires that no more than 3 commissioners can be of the same political party. So, so you have a good independent bipartisan Federal Trade Commission, right? No.
Yeah, which survives on to this day in perfect bipartisan.
Yeah, which would, well, no, of course, President Trump got to appoint the entire FTC because Mitch McConnell failed to allow Obama to appoint new commissioners when their terms expired because of course he did, right? So I am not making this up. When Donald Trump took office in January of 2017, there were only 2 commissioners on the Federal Trade Commission. And because Donald Trump is Donald Trump, he didn't get around to appointing new commissioners until May of 2018. So for a year and a half, the FTC had 2 commissioners, no chairperson. They worked under an acting chair who was a woman named Maureen Olhausen, who is a Federalist Society hack because, of course, she is. This was just not even on Donald Trump's radar. Finally, after a year and a half, Donald Trump managed to appoint folks to the FTC. And the people he appointed, the chair is a big law guy named Joe Simons. He was an antitrust lawyer at Paul Weiss, which is a Covington style firm. It's a big law firm. This is going to be the theme. The Federal Trade Commission really has 2 kinds of responsibilities. One is the Bureau of Competition, right, which covers antitrust, and it splits antitrust with the Department of Justice. We have talked about that in previous episodes, but broadly speaking, antitrust is non-competitive activities in the marketplace. The other division is the Consumer Protection Bureau. And it splits those responsibilities with the newly created Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So when I say that a guy like Joe Simons comes from the Bureau of Competition, that tends to be where your Republican nominees come from, right? They are concerned with the operation of how firms combine in the marketplace under the antitrust regs, right? What becomes non-competitive when Company A acquires Company B? The Facebook settlement here comes out of the consumer protection side, right? Because this is not about Facebook engaging in anti-competitive practices in the marketplace. It's about them misleading their customers. So keep that in mind when I tell you that the Republican nominees are more focused on the antitrust competition side than they are on the consumer side, which again, shouldn't be that surprising. So Simons, let me say, this guy is qualified, okay? He is not a political hack. That doesn't mean that he is not super far right, right? And it doesn't mean that he hasn't built his career on the antitrust side rather than the consumer protection side. But this is not a nonsense garbage pick. The other 2 staffers are
nonsense garbage picks. Well,
I can't even say that. They are Noah Phillips, who was the chief counsel to Texas Senator John Cornyn, and Christine Wilson, who was in-house counsel at Delta Airlines and had been a staffer during the Bush administration. That is, I will just say this, that's an incredibly thin resume to be an FTC commissioner. It is really hard to find anything that she did that would qualify her for this job. And look, there are a lot of antitrust lawyers out there. So, and there are a lot of conservative antitrust lawyers out there, right? I worked with one was my mentor at Covington and Burling. So, you know, infer what you want from that. The Democrats that Trump nominated are real grats, by the way. Rohit Chopra, who was moved over from...
Wait, why did he nominate Democrats?
Because Trump got to nominate all 5. because of Mitch McConnell.
I just assumed that would be five Republicans.
Remember, the FTC Act requires that you can only have three members of any one political party. Now, why Trump?
Can you get like fakers?
I don't know. I actually looked this up. I can find no case law that would prevent Donald Trump from nominating three Republicans, a Libertarian, and a member of the Constitution
and a Tea Party.
Yeah. exactly. So you could weaponize this. I suspect that
they're saying we found a way in which Trump hasn't been perfect evil.
Yeah.
Or McConnell hasn't been.
Oh, you could.
So
you
don't,
could be
don't
worse.
Broad publish
right.
this. Nobody download this.
Yeah. Keep this all under your head.
Solve that.
No. This is look. This is a way in which Democrats could maybe move the ball on congressional hardball in 2020.
Ooh, move the noodle. Yep.
Appoint three Democrats, a member of the Green Party, and a member of the DC Statehood Party. I suspect the reason that Trump didn't do this is really twofold. Number one, again, these positions went vacant for a year and a half. He clearly does not care. And number two, because in addition to not caring, he didn't want to spend any political capital. And so if you had done that, if you had nominated three Republicans, a Libertarian, and a member of the Constitution Party, then that would have immediately prompted a lawsuit.
Sternly worded letters?
Yeah.
Oh, no. And then there would have been one John Oliver segment and an opening argument segment, and then nothing would be done to prevent it, and it would be fine. So he should have just done it.
Well, but, he didn't want to risk... I think he didn't want to risk having...
Our wrath.
Yeah, the wrath of opening arguments. There you go. So with that, understanding that as the structural constraints, the Facebook penalty was a 3-2 vote. Right. So this is a voluntary settlement between the FTC and Facebook, with the two Democratic members dissenting. And by the way, those, like I said, they're real Democrats. Rohit Chopra, he was on the CFPB and he was moved over. Rebecca Slaughter was Chuck Schumer's chief counsel, and she has a background in consumer protection. So again, you see kind of this breakdown of the Republicans are on the competition side, the Democrats are on the consumer protection side. This is a consumer protection case. So what's the settlement about? 185 million Americans are daily users of Facebook. That's a staggering number. That is perhaps the largest installed base of any product in the United States. It's larger than Microsoft. It's larger than McCormick Pepper. It's larger than Morton Salt, right? Like that's
wow.
That's huge.
Where are you guys getting your salt? I would have figured everybody had the same salt. I guess not.
So I'm gonna link the settlement in the show notes. There are four main allegations that this settlement deals with, right? So in other words, the FTC said, hey, we think that Facebook may have committed an actionable breach of a 2012 consent decree. And here's what we think that is. So I guess let me do that. In 2011, the FTC filed an 8-count complaint against Facebook. Again, Obama FTC. After investigating Facebook's privacy practices. And it focused on what they called, and this is a direct quote, Facebook's deception, quote, it's specifically its representations about how it shares and protects user data, end of quote. And the net effect of all of the violations was to induce users of Facebook to handing over more data that Facebook could share with developers and third parties without their consent. So, for example, Facebook changed its website so that certain information that Facebook users may have designated as private, like their friends list, was made accessible by third-party developers without their approval. Facebook even made affirmative representations that those third-party apps would have access only to the user information that they needed to operate. Again, I want to quote from the 2012 consent decree. In reality, the apps could access nearly all of users' personal data, end of quote, despite promising them that they wouldn't share their personal information. So the Obama-era FTC investigated, found all these violations, and then rather than file a lawsuit against Facebook, entered into a settlement with Facebook. And they voluntarily entered into an order that did the following three things. Number one, barred Facebook from making misrepresentation about the privacy or security of users' personal information. Number two, required Facebook to obtain users' affirmative express consent before enacting changes that override their privacy preferences. And number three, required Facebook to establish and maintain a comprehensive privacy program designed to address those risks that would then be overseen by a third party. Independent assessments by an outside auditor every 2 years to determine whether Facebook practices, quote, met or exceeded the requirements of the order, end of quote. Facebook, this will not surprise you, violated that order. And they did so repeatedly and egregiously. In 2014, Facebook publicly announced that they would stop allowing third-party developers to access data from the friends of app users, but they allowed anybody who was, quote, grandfathered in, including the developer that gave all the information to Cambridge Analytica, to continue.
The Kremlin, anybody else.
To continue collecting data. Again, this is now from the Chopra dissent from this.
Is that typical, like in a data breach, you know, if when Equifax got hacked, where they're like, okay, we're going to change our passwords here, but the person who hacked us, your grandfather, you can still access the data. Just no new hackers.
It's like saying, oh, we're going to introduce, for anybody who signs up now, we're going to have new passwords, but we're not going to change any of the existing. The undisputed finding to which Facebook has agreed is that, quote, certain favored developers continued this collection well into 2018 to last year. So Facebook lied about the data they were collecting, lied about the data they were sharing. They misrepresented that they would to millions of users that they would have to turn on facial recognition technology, but in fact turned it on by default. And lied about collecting user phone numbers, said that this was just going to be, you know, a two-step authentication, but in fact used the phone numbers for advertising purposes. Okay, so Facebook did all this horrible stuff, including enabling Cambridge Analytica potentially to alter the results of the 2016 election, and continued to do that for years after Cambridge Analytica turned over tons of data to Donald Trump. So that's a bad thing. And so this settlement does three things. First, it imposes that $5 billion civil penalty. And as the majority points out, this is 200 times greater than the largest privacy penalty ever imposed in the United States. It's 20 times greater than the largest fine imposed in the world, right? Which was coming out of Europe pursuant to the General Data Protection Regulation. It is $5 billion is 9% of Facebook's 2018 revenue, 23% of its 2018 profit. So it is, it is correct to say it is one of the largest civil penalties in U.S. history. It ranks alongside, environmental damage, massive financial fraud. So it is a real fine. Second, it imposes new privacy requirements. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Third, before I get to third, in addition to the privacy requirements, it imposes what the majority says are structural reforms on how Facebook does business, including greater corporate accountability, more rigorous compliance monitoring, and increased transparency. There is a new independent board of directors focused solely on privacy, and Mark Zuckerberg and the designated compliance officers must each independently certify to the FTC that the company is in compliance with this order. False certifications would subject Zuckerberg and the officers to personal liability, including civil and criminal penalties. Before I get to the third thing, what do you think so far of the Facebook order?
Well, it sounds better than nothing. Yep. I mean, it sounds like there's an effort being made to make sure it's somewhat significant.
I think that's right. So then the question is, why have the Democrats on the committee dissented to this order? And the reason that they have dissented to the order is the third thing that the order does, which grants immunity to Facebook, and I'm going to read the immunity clause, which says, any and all claims that the defendant, its officers and directors, prior to the date of the settlement, June 12, 2019, violated the 2012 order. So that is an incredibly broad grant of immunity. And as somebody that, you know, negotiates settlements all the time, that language releases known and unknown claims that could arise because Facebook has concealed information, right? Any and all has zero exceptions to it. And it is not typical to release a party from liability for claims that you haven't even described yet, right? So here's how Chopra puts it in his dissent. He says, in agreeing to this proposed settlement, the majority has opted to give Facebook a legal shield of unusual, if not unprecedented, breadth. This shield represents a major win for Facebook, but leaves the public in the dark as to how the company violated the law and what violations, if any, are going unaddressed. I have not been able to find a single commission order, certainly not one against a repeat offender like Facebook, that contains a release as broad as this one. The committee is releasing both all known claims and any and all order violation claims, whether known or unknown, concealed or disclosed. Facebook also does not admit any wrongdoing, nor are there any formal findings of fact about its misconduct. So that, in my view, is the strongest objection, right? Is could you get the same conditions on Facebook without releasing them from literally everything? And does it make sense to release a repeat offender from literally everything, right? And, you know, and okay, changes to governments, they got to certify stuff, but they certified stuff to the 2012 order and they, you know, clearly lied about that. I want to point you to, I'm going to link this in the show note, page 8 of the Chopra dissent, which is entitled, Facebook's profit model is propelled by surveillance and manipulation. I will tell you, this will make you want to delete your Facebook account. Here's what it says.
But then how will I access the opening arguments community group? It's the only.
It actually is pretty much what I use Facebook for, is the opening arguments Facebook community. Chopra says, companies like Facebook have an incentive to curate content in ways that affect our psychological state and real-time preferences. For example, if Facebook's algorithms detect more engagement when users are sad or angry, then the company has an incentive to present content in ways that make users feel sad or angry. Even when companies like Facebook dispute that they are engaging in activities akin to mass surveillance or manipulation, their business incentives strongly motivate them to do so, and their technology enables it, regardless of whether or not it is a deliberate business decision. And, as Chopra points out, all of the compliance officers who are required to certify Facebook's conduct have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders of Facebook, a publicly traded company, not to the users, the customers of Facebook. So, in other words, if the business model is about Facebook manipulating its users in order to increase its revenue, it is highly unlikely that any of the proposed changes are going to overcome that in that built-in profit motive, not the least of which is because if a director fails to do that, then he can be sued by the shareholders in a derivative lawsuit for failure to act in a way to maximize the business profits. So in my view, that's a really, really good point. And the bottom line from a market perspective is after this was announced, after it was announced that Facebook was going to pay $5 billion fine, 200 times larger than any consumer protection fine ever handed down by the Federal Trade Commission, Facebook stock went up. So, you know, read that as, you know, as you will. I want to give you the counter argument, right? Because, again, I do not think that this is, right? This is not Mick Mulvaney at the CFPB, you know, dismissing out complaints against payday lenders, right? Which, by the way, he's done, and that's a monster. You know, it's a monstrous thing to do. The majority says, I would like to point out that this settlement is all the more remarkable given the FTC's limited authority. We are a law enforcement agency without the authority to promulgate general privacy regulations, like they have in Europe. Our authority comes from a 100-year-old statute that was never intended to deal with privacy issues like the ones we address today. We were faced with two choices. One, settle on excellent terms, or two, litigate for years and likely come away from even a favorable court decision with far less relief than we announced today. Would it have been nice to get even more? To get $10 billion instead of $5 billion, for example? To get greater restrictions on how Facebook collects, uses, and shares data? To get a more limited release? To put Mark Zuckerberg's name in the complaint caption? To the extent people object to our settlement because it does not have terms like these, we did not have those options. We cannot impose such things by our own fiat. Without a settlement, we would have had to go to court. Our authority in these cases is limited, which is why we've encouraged Congress to consider federal privacy legislation. But for now, the only real-world choice here was to take a historic settlement that provides immediate and important protection to American consumers rather than wait for years to get less relief. Like I said, I think that there is merit to that. I think there's a level of disingenuity, right? Because people like Simons are the people who have opposed broad sweeping privacy laws. I think the way you build on that is to say, look, this is what the Trump FTC is saying. They're saying we got everything we can and now we need new legislation. And so if you care about consumer privacy and if you care about reining in companies like Facebook, the FTC has handed you some ammunition, right? They have said in black and white, we would have liked to have done more, but we're hamstrung by the law. And, you know, that's one of those that I am shocked that consumer privacy groups have not really seized on this decision to kind of take the case to the public and go, okay, look, like you have Republican FTC commissioners going, we have encouraged Congress to consider federal privacy legislation. Let's get that on the agenda. So there's the settlement. It obviously is a complicated settlement. Yeah.
I mean, this strikes me as people in Facebook buying a get out of jail free card for some.
Yeah. No, money. That's exactly
is
right.
Basic,
yeah.
I mean, is that what it is? Like, they're like, oh, let's purchase the ability to be immune from some stuff later. And it looks like a big number, but
from stuff. And the crucial part, right, where I come down, and again, you know, look, like I really, really wanted, because, you know, OA thrives on, you know, hot takes where we don't necessarily come down with the Democratic dissent. And, you know, I would have loved to have said, no, I think this is the best deal you could have gotten. I'm really persuaded by the dissent's argument as to the scope of the release. And as a lawyer, I can't imagine not conducting the level of fact-finding necessary to identify what all the criminal violations were, right? To just say, Nope, we don't. You know, yeah, that's right. Blanket release. And look, I have agreed to blanket releases before, but I have agreed to those blanket releases in the context after considerable discovery and in the context of we really do know what's out there, right? Here's a situation where we don't know all the ways in which Facebook violated the 2012 consent decree. And I am definitely persuaded that at minimum, Facebook should have had to acknowledge and disclose to the public all of the ways in which it violated that that prior consent order. Yep.
Yeah.
And that'd be good. And look, that's the difference, right? That's why I started with the difference between the Democratic commissioners who come out of the consumer protection side versus the Republican commissioners that come out of the antitrust side, right? It's the difference between how do we rectify this competitive imbalance versus how do we really make the consumers whole? And that's what the Democrats were focused on. And I don't feel like that's been made whole, right? We do not know. And now the government agency that is charged with investigating these findings now can no longer investigate what Facebook did to empower Cambridge Analytica to potentially influence our 2016 elections. So there you go. Not a Mick Mulvaney, not a walk, a complex situation, but there you have it.
Well, thanks for the breakdown. Appreciate it as always. Opening Arguments is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. You know, I'm thinking about it back to my working at the state days. And I have to say, there were different units within my office. And certain units were more successful, more go-getting, more hardworking, all that kind of stuff. Certain units weren't. And I'm thinking back, I'm realizing a major part of that was the interview process. Hiring someone, finding a good candidate is not easy. In fact, it's the opposite. It is quite difficult. And when you don't find the right candidate, you either A, you've got a job that needs doing, you've got a whole position open and you're trying to catch up, you're falling behind on other stuff, or B, you're forced into hiring someone who's not a very good candidate because you just can't do the work anymore, the extra work. So you've got to find somebody, you find whoever's there, and then you're stuck with them, unfortunately. That's how hiring works. It's not so easy to fire somebody who's not quite good enough. That's where ZipRecruiter is going to help you. When you go to ZipRecruiter.com/OA, they will send your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And now I think it's time for some fun music lessons. Let's get to our C segment, Katy Perry and something called Flame.
Wait, sorry, got confused again. That's the traditional Christmas carol, Jolly Old St. Nicholas.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I a lot of people asked us about this, and the Stairway to Heaven lawsuit was a lot of fun, you know, chance to play some music, do some put Andrew through the ringer a little bit on that. That was fun. This one, so I had no idea, you know, I know who Katy Perry is, but I couldn't tell you what any of the songs, everything sounds the same to me these days, these same kinds of songs. So I didn't remember what this was, and I've certainly... Well, okay, I have a lot of Christian rap albums, too. But I don't have this one. There was a hole in my shelf where this Christian rock album should have been, and it's a huge oversight on my part, so apologies for that. I don't know how I missed it, but it's... So the song, I still don't know which is... I think the song is called Joyful Noise, and the group is called Flame. And I don't see, this is why we oftentimes see the law being reported badly. And I think in this case, I don't really know what the decision is here. I've seen a couple articles that I've tried to read, and they say different things about like what specifically the ruling is. So that's why we need Andrew to tell us, give us the details. But I'll give you my thoughts. I'm conflicted because on one hand, this is so elementary that it's got to be like the de minimis amount of music that could even be copied. I mean, it's literally three different notes. That's all it is. And then I don't know, some sources say like it's also the beat, but when I listen to the beat, the beat's not the same. So I don't, just the fact that there is a beat, I'm not sure what they ruled on. So let me find the relevant parts. So here's another thing to consider. The Katy Perry song has a few different parts. And for one, it starts off with a different little, what would you call it, a little riff. Here, let's just start it. It starts with this. And I kind of remember this from working out at the gym.
Yeah.
So that's not the thing. The thing that's the same is like shortly after that. And it's
Was this from the Left Shark again, Super Bowl? Was this one of the songs that...
You know, that same album.
That's me being topical, people. Yeah,
that was awesome. That's an original artistic idea right there. I don't think they got sued for that. But anyway, so then it switches to this. I'm capable of anything. And apparently that's enough, I guess, because now I gotta spin one of my old favorite records here, the Joyful Noise. It's actually, we can hear the beat here.
You know what it is? I love it. Yeah.
I'll go back to the other one. So, you know, it's actually, it's slightly different, which I guess when you're dealing in terms of percentage, when you've got three clown horning notes, you know, over the course of an eight count, if one of them is different, I know I'm going to sound like Vanilla Ice trying to say, oh, no, it's dum, 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 da, 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 dum, 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 da, 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 dum. But like, in fairness, like, yeah, I mean, one of them's, and then the other is, let's see, the other one was the,
let's talk about it.
Like, it's slightly different. And also there's a little bit of a, like, this one has some modulation on the notes. So it's like it's a little different, but like, I don't know. I mean, if all music is this simple now, then maybe you do need to adjust the law so that the three blind mice type melody is like enough to patent or whatever that you call it, you know, like, but this is so little. The only thing that I thought was funny though, as I listened to these, is they both have the same, little slow-mo breakdown-y thing. Let me get to that. So they both have the same little slow-mo breakdown thing here. I'll play the Katy Perry one. What's your mind? What's your mind? Hey, 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 hey. There's no going back. Okay. So keep that in mind.
I'll never forget that.
And so now compare that to my favorite Christian rap song I've ever heard. The top one that I've heard. And listen to this part. Here we go today. This is Hebrews chapter 1, if you care. I'm leaning to the right.
Yeah.
They both have that thing. I don't know how common that is. But I think that's a pretty common, like, little dancey breaky thing. I don't listen to this kind of music, so I don't know. But it seems like when I go to the gym or the store or wherever, you have to hear horrible music blasted at you that you don't like. It feels like I hear that a lot, where it's like the burr, 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 and then it goes into like a little thing. So I don't know. I can't tell you how common that is, but it is weird. Like, these songs happen 4 years apart. So it's kind of weird though. Like, it almost, I don't know. I can't decide what I think about this. Add into the mix that I guess Katy Perry was a Christian singer for a while. So like, I don't know. It's like kind of possible. Then again, I don't know how much of this song she wrote. You know, there's all kinds of producers and and writers that write for her. So I don't know. But I guess to sum up the musical analysis here, this just occurred to me, Andrew. In a world where music is this simple, maybe you need to, really home in on what you can copyright. I just remembered there's that famous song by composer John Cage called 4:33. That's just 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Is that like, does that mean John Cage wrote the only song that can be that? Like, if you do another silent song, it's like, oh, Mike, this is a blatant ripoff of John Cage's 4:33. I've actually just realized that. And it's kind of curious how that would work.
That is really interesting because you would have no protectable elements, right? So now we're going to get into what the Katy Perry lawsuit is actually about. So Flame is alleging, this is interesting to me, the complaint does not specifically allege, unlike, for example, the Led Zeppelin and Spirit complaint, mm-hmm. Spirit, the Randy California, the state of Randy California, was very, very clear. They're like, look, they ripped off the iconic.
We toured together,
it's less the access, but it was much more. We're claiming this specific part of Stairway to Heaven has ripped off Taurus. This complaint, I'm going to upload it. This is the most delightful complaint I have ever read. I've literally laughed out loud while reading it. I'm gonna read you my all-time favorite paragraph in any pleading. And mind you, I've read a number of Larry Klayman pleadings, and this is still my all-time favorite paragraph. There isn't a single cohesive theory of what is the infringement here. The allegation is that Flame owns the song Joyful Noise, and they have the right to create derivative works from that original composition. And so the argument by implication, but again, it's only by implication. It is not explicitly spelled out in the second amended complaint that Dark Horse is a derivative work from Joyful Noise, right? So,
I mean, isn't that the same claim essentially, though?
It depends, right? And so
it's more like claiming you sampled us versus but here's why this is backwards, though, because with Stairway to Heaven and Spirit or whatever the thing is, that was the same key, same chord progression. This isn't the same key. It's clearly not sampled. Like, it's the same three stupid generic notes, but like, that's easy to put, they didn't sample it. It's a different key, it seems the opposite of what it should be. It almost should be like Spirit is like, hey, you sampled our song, and this one would be, well, you copied the structure of it.
Because of the vagueness, I think that's exactly correct. Because of the vagueness of the complaint, the instruction that went to the jury, and I'm gonna upload the jury instructions, which I don't know that anybody else has these out here. I got them off of Pacer, so I have the actual check mark that the foreman sent back. So question
Breaking
one
news.
Is: did the plaintiffs prove by preponderance of the evidence that Dark Horse, that's the Katy Perry song, contains material from the musical composition Joyful Noise that is both original to plaintiffs and not commonplace expression? And that, right, but the jury says yes to that, right? Yeah. And again, with all of these, if there's a no, it kicks out and you go to a not guilty verdict, right?
Commonplace expression
is where
it should have been a no.
I said that colloquially. This is a civil lawsuit. There is not a guilty, not guilty. Just want to be 100% clear so that I don't have to do an Andrew Was Wrong segment for cracking a joke. so then, yes, move to question two. Did plaintiffs prove by preponderance of the evidence, and again, preponderance is just 51-49, more likely than not, that Joyful Noise and Dark Horse musical compositions are objectively substantially similar in copyrightable, protectable expression? And the answer to that is yes. And and that, I think, covers your 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence may be protectable as a whole, and you may have the right to create derivative works of silence. That seems kind of weird to me. But there are no protectable elements within that, right? Like, you can't...
Yeah. But, like, if we leave 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence in our podcast, like, not the actual, but just accidentally, like an editing mistake, could the estate of John Cage be like, hey, you played our song without
and there, without right, our and permission. There, I think the answer is no, because there is no underlying copyrightable, protectable expression, right? Because there's nothing.
Yeah.
So, but the...
I hate all of this. None of this. This is just a place where the law doesn't fit how reality is. Nobody bought the... Here's what it is. Anybody who spent any... And apparently this was like a semi-popular Christian rap song, which I still can't even comprehend this. If you watch the video, it actually just kind of looks like a normal rap video. So, like, I don't... My first question, and this is an honest question. Do these... people in this Christian group, Joyful Noise.
No, the group is Flame. The song is Joyful Noise.
Oh, sorry. Yep. Correction. Thomas was wrong. Andrew, legal question. Do they get laid? Like, what? Like, watch the video and it look like if you have the sound off, it looks like, okay, this is, you know, you're a musical group, you're doing a rap video, and there's like, you know, that's a component of it that you're popular, that your people like. But then you hear the lyrics, and it's, that's why I praise God for the word that we adhere. The word became flesh, lived for 30 years. Like, what? I don't, what is the point of this? I don't understand.
So I want to read you then. And again, they're two separate paragraphs. Paragraph three, summarizing this lawsuit, right? So this is in the introduction section, right?
The amount they get laid.
And this is the paragraph that is describing what it's about. Spoiler, this is not what it's about. I'm gonna tell you that in a minute. It is absolutely in no way the measure of damages under copyright. But paragraph three says, and again, I am reading this word for word from a document that I will upload in the show notes that I downloaded from an actual court of law. Quote, by any measure, the Dark Horse song also constitutes an infringement of plaintiff's copyright in their Christian gospel song Joyful Noise, released 5 years before Dark Horse. Now, they say by any measure. They don't describe what those measures are. Nevertheless, second sentence in this paragraph, second sentence. Specifically, defendant's unauthorized reproduction, distribution, and public performance of plaintiff's musical composition constitute infringement of plaintiff's exclusive rights in their copyright. Okay, so that's it. That's the sole sum of the thesis, right? Which is you're reproducing, distributing, and publicly performing our composition. I think you broke that down, right? But then that was just that was the appetizer. The paragraph I really wanted to read was the summary for that paragraph four, which says, and by any measure, the devoutly religious message of Joyful Noise has been irreparably tarnished by its association with the witchcraft, paganism, black magic, and Illuminati imagery evoked by the same music in Dark Horse. That's a real paragraph.
Yeah. Well, Dark Horse, the video is odd. Well, I mean, honestly, they're not
wrong.
Here
you have it.
Like, the dark, the
here you have it. Thomas agrees. Katy Perry is associated with witchcraft, paganism, black magic,
the Illuminati. It's a weird video is all I'm saying. I'm not saying that's not a bad description of the video is what I'm saying. But like, they just write it assuming that they've used their thing, but I don't understand how they're writing it this way. It's a different key. If they're writing it as though they sampled it, they didn't sample it, you know, like, don't they need to write this more in the spirit way, which is but anyway, this is why the law is stupid in this and it doesn't work, because nobody who listened to this Katy Perry song did so for the neep, 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 neep. Like, nobody who bought the single, and similarly, nobody who bought the Joyful Noise single, I guess, or whatever that is, listens to it for the neep, neep. Like, the thing that makes that song that is a bunch of weird lyrics about Jesus that kind of scare me that I don't understand. And the thing that makes the Katy Perry song a Katy Perry song is she sings a melody and she looks like Katy Perry. Like, that's what it, like, There's no melody in the rap song. It's just rap. Whereas Katy Perry, yes, it has the but that's one small part. The song sucks. I don't like it, but it at least has like has that little melody, and then the chorus is a totally different thing. It's like like at least.
Was that lyric?
And
are you
by the way
for a package store? I don't know.
I
but sometimes
no,
I am ready
I
for
know.
A package store.
but it, at the very least, and here's another thing that's interesting. The chord, well, it's I mean, interesting in so far as that you can analyze this music. The chord progression that it barely shows up in the rap song. You can kind of see it. Or you can kind of hear it rather, like in certain parts. So there is. So it's super basic, boring crap. And it would be interesting if it were the same in the Katy Perry song, but it's actually not. It's a different underlying chord progression. Let's rage. Well, there are no chords here. Let me see where I can find. See, when the chords come in, because they're not there in the beginning, you know, it's just that. But when they do come in, they're way different. That's four chords. It's a different progression. It's just not the same thing. Like it's all that's the same is meep, 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 meep. That's nothing.
I am ready for a dark
this
horse.
This is ridiculous.
I think that's what she was asking, right? I assume
that,
that she's playing chess,
like, it's
right?
Unlikely that she was
the
asking.
The little horsey. That's what I, anyway. It's a dark horse. She's black, right?
Yeah, I don't think she's talking about. Yeah, I don't think she's talking about package right. stores. I think it's safe.
Anyway, notwithstanding the fact that we are not qualified to evaluate Katy Perry versus Christian rap, you have sort of T3BE'd your way into the correct answer. So there is a correct answer, right? Which is we have is a jury finding of copyright infringement. And now what is left for the jury is to compute the damages. And the parties are submitting their proposed
Hail Marys.
I'm gonna read you the plaintiffs.
They're gonna pray about it real hard. That's what it should be. Katy Perry's like, I will ask the Lord for forgiveness. That should be it. Seriously.
I'm going to read you. This is Katy Perry's proposed jury instructions on damages. Now, again, the court doesn't have to accept these, right? The court is very likely to craft something that is in the middle. But these are taken from pattern jury instructions, and it's very likely that the jury is going to get something like this. So I'm going to upload this document as well. The fact that you, the jury, found a defendant liable for copyright infringement does not mean that the defendant is liable for profits. You may make an award of a defendant's profits only if you first find that the plaintiff showed, by a preponderance of the evidence, that there was a causal nexus between the infringement and that defendant's gross revenue. Mm. So then here's the instruction.
Yeah, no.
If you find that the plaintiffs have shown, by a preponderance of the evidence, that there is a causal nexus between the use of the Joyful Noise musical composition in, and here's where I need, Thomas, your help, Ostinato number 2 in Dark Horse and a defendant's gross revenue, you must then determine the portion that the defendant's net profits are attributable to the defendant, or to the infringement. So I don't know what an ostinato is, but it is that little segment that you have. I looked it up, and my understanding is it's that.
Oh, it's like a motif. Okay. You could have said motif, but yeah, it's the second. Number 2 is because the first one that's in the Katy Perry song is, and then it switches to the, so it makes sense that they would say it's the second thing.
And so that is, so the question that is going to the jury, right, on computation of damages, right, is going to be something that says, hey, figure out what the gross revenue is for Dark Horse, which, by the way, is a galactic ton of dollars, yeah. Right? Yeah. So it's an unbelievable amount of money. And then it says,
here's how I would do it. Can I give you how I would do it? I'd go, Your Honor, or the jury.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
Do you think, yeah. Do you really think that if everything in this Katy Perry song were the same, except that one thing went, that it would just $0? Like, they wouldn't have made any money on the damn thing. You needed it to be, like, it doesn't matter. You put in anything. Literally, you just put in anything in the computer program that you're making the song in. That's nothing. That's no part of the song.
And that's what the jury is going to be called upon to decide. How much is there a causal nexus, right? How much did the fact that Katy Perry copied Ostinato number 2 from Joyful Noise, how much did that contribute to the success of Dark Horse? And, well, at
zero.
She wants you on that jury.
$15.
She definitely wants you on that jury.
Yeah. I mean, whatever. Yeah, maybe give them a
Can I point out exactly? Yeah, I like now, using this those is, legal phrases. I'm really, really glad we got to do this, because this is exactly what plaintiffs' lawyers are counting on, is the behavior you just expressed among members of the jury, right. Which is they're going to say Dark Horse made $85 trillion. And,
exactly.
Even the most cynical person,
hand him $1 trillion,
and even the most cynical person on the jury, Thomas, is going to be like, fine, whatever. Give him a couple hundred million. I don't care, right?
I think they should rule that Jesus said you could sooner fit through the eye of a needle than be a rich person and make it to heaven. So we'll actually take money away from these Christian rappers to help them go to the heaven they believe in. Then everybody's happy, right?
I'm with you on that.
Katy Perry, you like money. Christians, you're not supposed to have money. I think I found a solution.
I'm with you. So can we end with, I've been teasing this all segment. The paragraph 4 of the deep, irreparably tarnished by its association with the Illuminati was great. The best paragraph in any complaint that I have ever read is paragraph 39. Okay. So I need to give you a little bit of setup for that, right? Because there's lots of, because I'm laughing the whole way through, because, you know, one of the things you do, and anybody who's read a complaint, you know, followed along with us in OA knows, you know, you identify the parties, right? So it's the plaintiffs. It's plaintiff Marcus Gray, you know, known as Flame, is an American Christian hip hop musician. And then it goes to the defendants, right? Defendant Catherine Elizabeth Hudson, professionally known as Katy Perry, right? WB Music. Jordan Michael Houston, professionally known as Juicy J. Did not know that, so that's kind of neat. Yeah. BMG Rights Management. Defendant Lukas Gottwald, professionally known as Dr. Luke. Right? So that goes through all these. Henry Russell Walter, professionally known as Circuit, C-I-R-K-U-T. That's a great handle. Cobalt
one.
Music Publishing. So it goes through all of that.
When we're in one of these lawsuits, is it going to be Andrew Torres, professionally known as
Optimus Prime. Prime? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
PKA Optimus Prime. Yes. and so then they have to explain who's got what, right? So as you pointed out, right, Katy Perry has 8 people writing the song, and like the copyright goes from this person to that person. So, you know, as any good plaintiffs, you sue everybody and let the court figure it out. And then as they're explaining who owns what, we get paragraph 39, which I'm going to read word for word, even though Brian may or may not clown horn a particular word in here. According to the Copyright Office records, each of the 6 individual defendants has transferred his or her copyright ownership interest in the composition of Dark Horse to the alias or entity identified above. For example, the Copyright Office records show that defendant Katy Perry has transferred her copyright interest to a something known as, quote, "When I'm Rich, You'll Be My Bitch," end quote, with the same address as defendant WB Music, end of paragraph.
They have
alleged that Katy Perry has transferred her copyright interest to a something.
I thought that was like a bad word.
No.
I, what?
has transferred her copyright interest to a something known as When I'm Rich, You'll Be My Bitch, with an address the same as Defendant WB Music. I don't even know what to say. Like, that's some fantastic lawyering, and I really, really want to use, you know, to a something, right?
Like they can't say.
Yeah,
what,
we don't know.
Like
we don't know. Is
normally
this
say like LLC?
Right? Is it an LLC? Is it a corporation? Is it just, you know, a post office box drop? I don't know. I to a something. I absolutely love it. And also, I'm going to start. If you've got a business out there and you'd like to register, When I'm Rich, You'll Be My Bitch LLC. Drop us an email.
Your Honor, I demand to know. Question from the jury. I demand to know if the artist Flame gets laid for doing this Christian rap. I want to know. I can't make a decision about the case until I know that.
So there you go. So that's what we're waiting on. The jury has found infringement. Yeah. And then what's coming next is the battle over the instructions as to how they are to compute damages. And then the jury will come back with damages. And we did not coordinate and orchestrate this, but if we had, we couldn't have done it any better to show sort of like, even if the jury is super skeptical, they're gonna be like, yeah, she made the net worth of the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, give them a couple million and let's call it a day. And I agree that, I think the top line, the takeaway. So I will say this, maybe it's because I love Led Zeppelin and I love that style of music. This seems far more like once you started doing the, and I'm not going to do it, but you know, the dun 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 dun, right. Once you started doing it, I was like, oh yeah, no, this is the same song. Like I totally get the result that the jury came up with.
But you know, that's kind of hard because on one hand it is the dun 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 dun, but on the other hand, And you know, that's what is it? Two notes, dum 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 da da dum dum. That's all it is, two notes. But on the other hand, Vanilla Ice did rip that off. Like, so like it's hard to, you know? So I guess it's a little more complicated than I'm making out. Like something could be really simple, but also definitely a ripoff. But this to me is more, okay, it's not in the same key. It's not even the same instrument. Like it's a different sounding synth instrument that they've got. They've got a few different effects on it. It's like I said, it's a different key. It's a slightly different note on one of the part on one of the duns. You know, like I don't know. It's tough. But I think it's a little different than saying, oh no, dun 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 dun. Like you just added one note on the same instrument, the same key, the same sound. People recognize that like as that other song, you know, as Under Pressure. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's tough. Or maybe it's not tough. Maybe I just made a difference right there. Did I just distinguish the two to your liking?
I think I go back to your initial comment, right? Which is the law is very clearly not set up to address the right? Like, if this is what music is today, then we probably need to rethink what constitutes minimally protectable elements and recognize that that's different than like, you know, the chiffons and George Harrison, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Music isn't music. I wish Katy Perry would get there in front of the thing and testify and be like, look, any piece of crap that I shovel in front of this audience would have sold the same. They would have sold the same amount. It has nothing to do with it. Oh. All it is, like, it's a little bit the singing and the melt. Like, okay, you know, it's a little chorus that people maybe, you know, it's super simple. Maybe people like it. But, like, it has nothing to do with the three synth notes. Like, the amount of success she has, it's the video, it's the image, it's her brand. All that stuff is far more integral to the $83 trillion you referenced. And the three synth
so
notes.
as we're bringing the segment to a close, like that one of the most hilarious moments that was from the trial that was commented on in the news sources was that in cross-examination the plaintiffs had difficulty with the AV equipment getting Dark Horse to play, and Katy Perry was like, well, you know, I could sing it for you. And you know, and the jury laughed at everything, which, but you know, good thing to do when you're the defendant. Didn't ultimately help her much, but I kind of like that, envisioning that moment of being on the jury and then, you know, trying six or seven times to get the song to play and having her be like, I could just sing it for you.
Of course.
But you have to imagine the jury would be so like, weird. Yeah, I kind of want to, you know, live special Katy Perry concert for just the 12 of us over here.
Might as well.
All right, we're done.
We've got to get to thanking our new patrons. Yeah, maybe next music case will be something worth busting out an instrument for. This is not that at all. Oh, but I did want to, just final question. Was there any mention of the beat being part of it? Because I saw that referenced in like half the articles and then the other half it wasn't.
So it is, I read you, the answer to that, as far as I can tell, is no. I read you.
Good, because the beat's not the same. I saw, again, and I said these were actual news sources. This wasn't, you know, it was like Pitchfork or, you know, different music, a popular music website saying like, oh, the beat and the thing. It's like, no, the beat's not the same. Okay, but I don't have to get into that.
So, let me clarify a little bit, right? It is,
all right,
one of the jury findings was question 7. Did plaintiffs prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the inclusion of the instrumental music, i.e. the beat created by Mr. Ojukwu in Joyful Noise, is part of a work of joint work of authorship with the other plaintiffs? Yeah. What? So...
Oh, hold on. Who was that name?
Mr. Ojukwu, who is one of the other rappers in Flame, or one of the other members. He may not be a rapper, but...
What? So is that like a question under the assumption that they did copy the beat, which they definitely didn't?
So here's what it is. So it's, his name is Chike, C-H-I-K-E, Ojukwu, O-J-U-K-W-U. And he is identified in the complaint as an American Christian hip hop musician and record producer and citizen of the state of Missouri. Right. So the question is not, is the beat the part necessarily the part that was infringed, right? It is that the beat created in Joyful Noise is part of the joint work of authorship from which...
Oh, so he gets to be in on it,
right, basically. Exactly.
I hear you. Yeah, even though... I mean, honestly, if they're separating out, like, he did the beat and somebody else did the... like, he probably shouldn't be a part of it because the beat is no part of the infringement.
And but so whatever. What it says is, right...
So it's all wrong.
That his part in creating the beat was part of the overall work, and it's the overall work that was... infringed by creating Dark Horse as a derivative.
I think that's just, it's just a way to get him in on it. That's none of that is true.
Just, in my view, that is likely the, you know, music reporting sources trying to parse through, you know, this.
Yeah, well, that's complicated. I'm glad you broke that down because I see what they're trying to say. That's definitely... I don't see that as a valid claim that the beat was ripped off, but I see it's like, okay, the guy who wrote the beat, he should be in on this too because he contributed to the work of art that we're saying was ripped off. Even though it's nothing, the beat is not the same. It's not, if those two beats are the same, every beat is the same as every beat and just, it's over. It's all over at that point.
No, like, and look, you heard what Katy Perry's legal team has described as sort of the basis for damages, right? It is... Ostinato number 2, which is not the beat.
Well, no, the beat is part of it.
Okay, fine.
But yeah.
But it is.
Yeah. But anyway,
the entirety of the composition.
So yeah. All right. Well, that was fun. And I look forward to next time. Music law. Music court. Dum dum.
Dun 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 dun.
All right. We've got to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. And we begin with Griffin J. Campbell. Joshua Mulliken, Viva Puerto Rico Libre, hashtag Ricky Renunci... Sorry, it's all blending together. I can't read this. Hashtag Wanda Renunci... I don't know what that is. Sorry, I can't read the letters blend together and I don't know those. I'm not familiar enough with the words to know where the separation is on the... Sorry. Anyway, James Heath, Jerry Reynolds, Bryce Nickel, Conrad Michaels is a deep state conspiracy. Alexa, send a message to mom. Lori Lynn Mayhew. Oh, Lori Lynn, thank you for the phonetic pronunciation there that you gave me to make sure I didn't mess it up. Other people could also do a similar thing. Bruce Chapman. No, it's okay. Hey, we will thank them however they come. Eeyore Dragon. Huh. John Strange and Amy Gernon. Your turn.
Thank you to Moxon Brittlebane. That is a fantastic name. Kyle. Natalie Schwartz. Thanks, Natalie. Danger Zone. Danger Zone, as in Highway to the Danger Zone, I hope. Christian V. Axel Hobson. Tamia Lee Sorensen. Welcome to Arguing Openments. I totally did that spoonerism of I read it as opening arguments, even though it's AO. All right. Franco Haruskeman. Moscow Mitch says, off to the gulag. David and Brandon Temple. Thank you so much for supporting the show.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Yes. All right. Time for T3BE. Does the streak continue? Can I manage to get 100 of these things wrong in a row? Let's find out.
All right. So, Thomas, this was a question involving actually the justiciability of claims, really. And so this was a federal statute that requires the National Bureau of Standards to establish quality standards for beer. And the idea was that some officials have publicly said, oh, beer's got to be pasteurized. And so a brewery that makes unpasteurized beer, that sounds a little gross, by the way. But I mean, who knows? Maybe it's delicious. We asked our brewery friends. But,
yeah, maybe it's great. I don't know. I'll try.
I will definitely try unpasteurized beer. cut to the future to like me dead. Like, yeah. This TTTB, this T3BE counted as assumption of risk. Anyway, so brewery sues in federal district court to enjoin the Bureau from adopting standards that would prohibit the sale of unpasteurized beer. What should the district court do with this lawsuit? You very confidently eliminated A and B, which was basically consider the lawsuit, and then went with no, we're not going to adjudicate the merits of the suit at all. You were choosing between C, staying the action until the Bureau actually issues the standards, or D, dismissing the suit and saying, oh, look, this is not a justiciable case or controversy. And Thomas, I am pleased to tell you the streak is over. D is the correct answer.
I was going to say, I mean, I was pretty sure it was D, like that, but I've been pretty sure the past five weeks.
I know. No, you got this. You analyzed it exactly right. You got it exactly right. Courts only can decide actual cases or controversies until they promote the standards, until they promulgate the standards. As you pointed out in Friday's episode, right? Like otherwise people could just sue for speculative stuff all the time. Really thought I was crossing my fingers and crossing my toes for you
that I maybe would say C.
Because C I think has a lot of plausibility as a seeming, you know, as a seemingly, you know, middle ground, equitable kind of thing. But what you're missing is that, what the hypothetical person, not you, you didn't fall for this.
Oh no!
The hypothetical person who might go for C would be missing that dismissing a case, dismissing a lawsuit for failure to allege a justiciable case or controversy is a dismissal without prejudice, right? You come back and be like, "Oh, when they actually pass the regulation, then sue and get an injunction," right? So there's no reason to keep it on the docket, stay proceedings if there's not an actual live case or controversy at the time that the suit is filed. So congratulations. Great job.
I don't say this all the time, but I nailed it.
You absolutely did.
I didn't. There was no luck involved in this guess. I got it. It was
exactly right.
Exactly right
for the exact right reasons.
Yeah. I'm back.
And I have to tell I wasn't going to tell you this at the time. This was the difference. You are now 76 for 137, which is 55.5%. Had you gotten it wrong, you would have slipped below 55%. So,
and we all know that's the most important thing.
I'm recalibrating expectations. So let's.
How dare you? I will get to that 60%. Yes, you will. I'm studying as hard as I ever have, and I should be able to. All right. Well, let's hop in the time machine and find out who won this week's T3BE, even though I won, but somebody else also tied.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, lots of people played along with this one, and we had some fantastic guesses that combined unripe lawsuits with, you know, can unfermented beer be as unripe as this lawsuit? That's Danielle Fisher. Lots of good stuff here, but I think this week's winner is going to be pithy, delightful, hilarious from Stephen Elliott on Twitter, who says, I think the correct T3BE answer is D, but it would be A in a parallel universe where all judges were required to drink beer before issuing any orders, which would then be known as beery decisis. So congratulations, Stephen, on being this week's winner. Everyone give him a follow. That is at Stephen, StephenElliottM. I guess there were a couple different Stephen Elliotts out there. So Stephen Elliott M on Twitter. Congratulations for being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Come to the live show. Woo! There may be tickets left or probably not. I don't know. But either
there may be a special appearance by Katy Perry or probably not.
Oh, I thought you were going to actually say who there might be. So no, there's going to be special appearances. It's not going to be Katy Perry. It'll be me going the entire time. I will recite the entire song in that form. And then Andrew will sing the Katy Perry.
Sure.
No. All right. We will see you then. Thanks so much for listening.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission. Welcome to Opening Arguments.
No, you messed it up. Can you read it again? But pay attention to what it says.
Oh, yeah.
It's part of the joke. This is awesome. Leave this all in.
Don't leave any of this in, Brian.